We get the program underway this afternoon by visiting with legendary lighting designer, a Tony Award nominee, the man behind the lighting for events like the Monterey Pop Festival, the Newport Folk Festival, Woodstock, where he also served memorably as the master of ceremonies. He has worked with everybody in the music business through the years, and it's a real treat for us to have a chance to talk over the phone from his home in Australia with Chip Monk. So grateful to you for making some time for us today.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. More than pleased. Thank you.
So much to talk about with you, but I thought the beginning seems like a logical place to start. And I want to talk about your mother and how she introduced you to live theater and Broadway shows. But as I understand, she wrote a note saying that you had to go to New York for medical reasons every week?
No. The first Wednesday of every month.
Ah.
That way she could catch two shows, which were her passion, musical comedy.
That's wonderful.
And I just watched all of this, magnificent sunsets and sunrises and brilliant costumes and vocals, and started wondering how do I deal with my music rather than this? It wasn't discarding musical comedy because it's neat, but I just wondered how do you deal with this folk music trend, because you can't do it like this.
What was it about seeing those Broadway shows that drew you not to acting or composing or anything like that, but to telling a story with light?
Well, my light is really far less entangled than a Broadway show. I've done two Broadway shows. Got a Tony nomination for each one, for Rocky Horror and one for Bette Midler. And my last show with Bette Midler in Pasadena was 920 instruments.
Wow.
So I got everything in that water. There was no way she could get away.
Can you tell the story of how you became involved with Charlie Altman and his company as a very young man?
Yeah, well, Abe Feder and Jeannie Rosenthal were corralled one evening by my mother, who was a very chatty person and had no boundaries. And they said to me, you know, what you really should do is you should contact Charlie Altman in Yonkers. And subsequently, Mom gave me $250 and said, okay, don't bother trying to make your classes on Thursday. Go to Yonkers and start pounding on garage doors. Because the nice part about it is telephone books in that age had also the address.
Right.
So the third garage door I banged on, Charlie was there, and I said, hi. I want to work on the benches because I want to learn more about the instrument and what I can get out of it and why it does what it does. Okay. Gel these last follow spots to the 902s here, and don't forget to bend the clips over. Yes, I understand, sir. So they don't one frame doesn't foul the other. Yeah, got it. Said, I'll be back in a while. You just gel those, and we'll see how we go. And so he went away and came back and said, hey, that's not bad. Why don't you stay here tonight and come in tomorrow morning and meet the guys and see what you think of the shop. And that is, I was working at the Village Gate at that time. So what basically the deal was, all of the instruments that came back on rental, slightly bruised, battered, or giving up a ghost, he said, well, you know, when you get to know all that, what you can do is you can just take a look at the parts areas, which is here and here, and you can use all those parts to rebuild or make good again those instruments, your lighting instruments, and then you can take them to the gate. The only thing you can't do is you can't have a new lamp that you have to pay for, but if you always use a dimmer, then you'll be able to live with the lamps that came back if they still work. What a wonderful deal. So Art DeLugoff got everything he needed for the gate, and I started on the path.
And the gate, for people who don't know, that was Thompson and Bleeker, and everybody who was anybody, and certainly in the world of folk music, played there, and comedians and a wide range of talent.
Oh, it was amazing. Let me just drag it up here for a minute. Jay talent list. It was really quite amazing. It was Odetta, Josh White, Jeffrey Holder, Brock Peters, Leon Bibb, Miriam McCabe, Belafonte folk singers, Ornette Coleman, Charlie Mingus, Thelonious Monk. The most difficult was trying to measure bars for Coltrane and Mingus. And who else? That was about it. And Miles, of course. Because the old my traditional view of music is always, you know, four beats to the bar, and solos are basically anywhere from 8 to 16 to 32 to 64 bars, and then you quit. But those rules didn't apply. So I had to learn it all over again.
And you were living in the basement at the time, is that right?
Yeah, just about 20 feet away from the gate in the old kitchen of the Mills Hotel.
And you met Dylan, I understand, at the Kettle, right?
Yeah, at the Kettle of Fish, and then ended up. He said, "You got a typewriter?" I said, "Yeah." Yeah. He said, "Great. Can I use it?" Yeah, of course you can. So he rarely spoke, except when he had something he needed. And so I gave him a set of keys. Then I said, well, you know, I have to, at four in the afternoon, I have to be in the gate for either sound checks or recolor or whatever I have to do. So you can come in any time, and I come back in at about 1 o'clock, and, use it. It's yours. Enjoy it. And then at the end of those sessions, I used to go to the wastebasket, take out all the drafts and everything, and iron them, put them in the folder. I unfortunately put that underneath the garage, or underneath the barn in Bridgehampton, New York, where I was with Barbara Jansen. And unfortunately, she sold the house before letting me know, yeah. And all of that went away somehow. So that folder is missing.
My. How did you get together with Albert Grossman?
He was often in the gate seeing what he could manage, what he could deal with. And he wanted Joni Baez, but she was being managed by Manny Greenhill in Cambridge and really liked him. But he said, okay, I'll put you into Newport with George Ween and Charlie Bourgeois and the rest of them. And what I want you to do is make Joni look beautiful, and then I'll pounce on her. Oh, I said, okay, thank you. And so I spent about six years with George Ween, and then he started to count his pennies, and I moved along.
We're talking with Chip Monk here on Downtown. You've described Newport as overlit and not very sophisticated.
Well, there were no foul spots, so I couldn't use my paintbrushes. It was difficult because you have a down center position where an individual work or a duo, then you need an area left and right of that for a slightly larger group, and you might as well take it out so that there's center, there's left center, there's right center, then there's left off stage and right off stage. So there's five little areas of light in all of the colors that you use, and also tied to the back light color, which is really important because in the evening, that's the only way the artist has somebody to relate to. They're lit and they become whole three-dimensionally because of back and front light, as well as a bit of side. And I forgot the point. It happens at this age.
Well, you've
but
said
it'll
that
come up in the middle of this next sentence, it'll come up again. It's like when I'm lecturing or doing a presentation. If I just have to remind the audience that if there's a blank in the middle of all of this, it means that I've forgotten the name. But try and remember that particular area. because it'll come up in the middle of the next sentence, and then you have to refer back to that because you have the answer. That's how I deal with old age.
But you've said that front light is your forte. What do you mean by that, Chip?
The lighting basically is the directorial influence of the audience of what to look at now, what I've chosen as primary, and the color, the size of the follow spot, which generally is always bottom of the guitar to top of head, size of the iris. What I'm doing is I'm giving you on the musician or the vocalist or something. It is brighter or more saturated color to call your attention to it, because that's what I think you should be watching now, but I'll give you the rest of the band or other soloists as they come up. So what I'm doing is really telling you what to look at. But it's like a pastry bag nozzle. Okay? You didn't understand that, right?
Want to go to 1967 and talk about the Monterey Pop Festival. And apparently, you didn't spend a lot of time with Lou Adler and John Phillips once they told you what they wanted.
Yeah, he just said, light it. And by the way, stage manage it. And they had offices across from the Riot House or the Hyatt House in Los Angeles. And David Enderle arrived one morning with Al Cooper and said, Here's your new helper. I know you need one for choosing amps and all the rest of that, and what to do with the back line, et cetera. And he's now yours, so deal with it. And then he left and left me with Cooper. And he worked out great. It was we had a mild argument in reference to the fact that we were going to be moderately reasonable in the changeover times, that it wasn't going to be done, as Lou mentions it, as vaudeville, where you had to hurry up, get rid of that act, put another one on immediately. We just sort of lounged in the time that it took, and finally ended up playing recorded music in the break between. And he was a great help, Cooper. He even got OCD mechanical by carrying little pieces of chain in his pocket or small lengths of rope, because when all of the Fender amps that were given to us, of which there were 16, there were four on each cart. The cart was maybe 3 foot by 8 foot with four casters on it, and then four amps slightly overlapping each other. And we just wheel the number of carts that held the numbers of speakers and amp heads behind whoever was playing, and let them plug into that. And of course, the carts had a tendency to move, especially the drum riser, because of the action on it. And you took a short length of chain or a piece of rope and just tossed it around two of the casters on any of those dollies, and they didn't move. So Al had his rope and his chain in his pocket, and it was a great help.
Did you work with D.A. Pennybaker at all?
No, not at all, except for the fact that I cursed him, unfortunately, by having come just arrived to be picked up at Los Angeles Airport by Alan Parisa, coming in from London from Peter, Paul, and Mary tour. At Monterey, this was the very long days that sometimes just overlapped each other. I asked for a Purple Heart, which in the UK was amphetamine. And somebody gave me something else that was purple, and so Pennybaker spent about 2 hours color correcting such things as tune that Artie said that, oh, my heavens, how delightful, a ballad in red. Well, that's all I could see for about 2 hours was red. That's the only thing that worked for me, because I was tripping, which I don't do anymore.
There were bands that didn't want to be a part of Monterey Pop, the Beach Boys among them. Did that damage their career?
No, because we brought him back in 83 in San Diego after the Padres beat the Cubs. It was a full house of 67,000 on Mother's Day, where we rolled the stage in exactly a half an hour.
Wow.
And 9 speaker carts and all that sort of stuff. And did music after sport. And we used them a lot in the Doobies and in the Ronstadt. But the Beach Boys were great in that, because if the sound was moderately deficient because of the size of the ballpark, you knew the lyrics so well, it didn't make any difference.
What was your experience working with Bill Graham?
Confrontational. Mm. Every now and then we did end up punching each other, but it all came out in the wash. He's brilliant, and it was great fun working with him. He was there at Monterey sourcing talent. So was Adler, and also the original promoter, who was what was his name? I have it here somewhere on. Bernie Shapiro. So Parisa, who was basically the founder of the whole idea, and Lou credits him very politely. His family owned Lily Cup, so he had all the funds that he wanted to use, and this was his dream. And by the time everybody else kicked in what they could and bought the time from the Monterey, the city of. And it became basically self-promoted. It's really interesting. Very interesting indeed. It was a very strange arrangement to just let them deal with themselves and the little areas that they wanted to control. When Parisa dropped me off at Monterey after driving me up from L.A., the thing that was interesting was I asked the groundskeeper, do you have any ladders? Nope. Would you like to see my drawings? Yeah, okay. And my drawings were all half-inch scale, so I could have the instrument number and the color and the type of instrument all written in on each lap, and then referring to a hookup sheet so you could find out what dimmer it was on. And why did I start that? I'll finish the sentence in the middle of your next question.
All right, well let's move ahead. Let's move to Woodstock, which moved itself from Wallkill to Max Yasgur's farm, and that left you and Michael Lang and everybody else with, what did you have, 3 weeks to prepare?
No, just a little shy of 2 weeks.
Wow.
And the roof had to be built. We unfortunately chose Steve Cohen's roof, and it turned out not to be load-bearing. It was so heavy that it was just capable, really, of only supporting itself. So that meant that 750,000 watts or 750 instruments, lighting instruments, were sitting underneath the stage rusting. And all I had to light a feature film was 12 follow spots, which was a bit of a chore, because my filmer East crew, being used to a 5-hour call, which constituted an evening, didn't like 8 or 9 hours worth of darkness to work. So they started to bail. So I made numbers of announcements asking if if anybody had worked a follow spot or worked in theater or has a desire to, would you tell security that I've invited you, meet me under the stage during any time, any act. So I'd announce the act and then hop below the stage where we had all the velour and the curtains that we were going to mask everything with. We're now hung to give us total darkness underneath the stage, and my 13th safety lamp of the 12 follow spots, number 13 wasn't necessary. So that was the test instrument. So the cue of it all, or the importance of it all, is that carbon arcs, or those follow spots at that time, burned 2 pieces of pencil-thin carbon wrapped in copper, and they're pointed towards each other in the correct position within the lamp, which was all terribly easily adjustable or taking out of adjustment. And that only gave me 41 minutes for trim. So that means that I have to start each lamp maybe 10 minutes up there. So one lamp would run out of trim, or the fire in the box, as it basically was. It didn't have a lamp. It just had this literally a fire in the box by these two carbons burning down to zero. Point being that, therefore, with everybody starting with a different length of trim or length of carbons, would run out of efficiency or almost turn themselves off at a prescribed time. So I'd start with the guy that started with the shortest carbons, get him retrimmed or put new fire in the box, and move to the next guy who was going to eclipse. So it was moderately difficult, but I managed to find enough operators by just teaching them during the day underneath the stage.
And you became master of ceremonies. Do you think it was in Michael Lang's plan all along to have you be the MC?
I certainly do. Yeah, he's pretty bright. except that the revisiting Woodstock, as he tried to do, unfortunately just started to take the mystery and the rosettes off the cake, because it really was only a cash grab. It wasn't to continue the work, which is a shame. But he said at about 7 o'clock in the morning, well, we've neglected to hire a follow spot operator, and an MC, and you're it. thank you. The marvelous part about it was that I didn't know any earlier, so I wasn't trying to figure out who I was going to be or to fabricate a persona. I just had to work with what I had immediately, which was with my knees knocking together. So the confrontation started out with, okay, you folks in the row are getting a little too close to the plywood wall of the film crew. And when the rest of the audience arrives, as they seem to be doing, you're going to be pressed up against that plywood for the next 3 days, you know, looking at the nuts, and you're not going to have a great time. So what I'm going to ask you to do is, you folks in the front, pick up all your stuff, if you don't mind. I'm going to ask you to step backwards. I don't suggest you turn around. I just back up so it doesn't appear to be an offensive move against the people behind you. And those nice little soft impressions in the grass that you've made and so comfortably sit in now, you will be able to find the ones that somebody has made for you further back. So I'm going to count you backwards and ask you to move back, just maybe about 10 feet, 10, 20 feet. Just take big steps back, and I'll tell you, when we get to 10, you can stop. So I started counting, and one, two, three. Geez, they're doing it. Maybe this isn't going to be so hard. and we got them back 10, 15 feet, and then the two stakes and the piece of clothesline, which was our barrier, was reset, and nobody ever breached it thereafter. So, and it was pretty easy dealing with them, because it unlike some of the other folks that were helping me do some announcements, you know, all my cues came from them. You are telling me what you need, and then I try and fix it for you.
Little did you know that for the rest of your life, though, people would be asking you about the brown acid.
Yeah. Well, we don't even know if there really was any. The request came from a doctor from the medical tent, and I assumed it was real. But then, of course, the question was the horror of what happens if this person who's listening to you is on a trip with perhaps brown acid. You know, what's he going to do? How are they going to feel? So, if you take guidance from the assembled and try and solve their problems or their issues, it gets easier, because there's a rapport that's built, and they know that when you start to talk even more softly, without screaming at you, that there's something important for you to listen to, and it may be the solution to one of your requests.
So, Chip, what made that weekend work?
Everybody, I think, took a peek at where they were and what was lacking, and figured that there was no need for argument or throwing punches or getting too boisterous, you know. And the thing that worked out so wonderfully was if the turntables had broken by all the people who were on the stage, all standing on that extra 18 inches so they'd get a better view from behind the act, if the caftan hadn't given out because we didn't use steel frame, we used lumber. And of course, lumber, casters, like bolts and lumber, is not strong enough to hold 20 people sitting on it when you only expected six or so of an act and their amplifiers at center so you could turn at the turntable. Then we would have had maybe 5 to 10 minutes of changeover time. But that meant in the 24-hour period, you'd have 16 hours of acts because of your efficiency.
Right.
And what are they going to do for the other 8 hours? Torture the neighbors? You know, we already had enough problems with the community. Certainly not Max, but his neighbors, of course. And so, strangely enough, every now and then, all of these major concerns were basically taken care of all by themselves. Somebody was watching over us. And that's basically how we got along with each other. The whole delight of Woodstock was the fact that that many people who didn't know each other for all intents and purposes got along quite well. And it was the second largest community in New York State for that weekend. And, you know, the freeways closed, so everybody had to use helicopters to get in and out. So it turned out to be quite a reunion or a union of people. And they shared all sorts of thoughts and items. And the problem was there was nobody or there was no new nucleus that could take all of that, those good vibes, so to speak, and carry them on to do something or get something done with it, with the strength that they had in fact created. So it just sort of it just fell to Michael to try and produce more of them. And unfortunately, every time it happened, it got less effective and least desirable.
Well, including later that year with the Stones at Altamont, and that was, I guess, in many ways, the dark side of what we saw at Woodstock.
Well, that just happens when you have 300,000 people and you have no facilities for them, no food, no drink, no nothing, right? And then Rock Scully, Emma Drogan, and Sam Cutler, who was road management at that time for the Stones, decided that the Hells Angels, because of their work in Candlestick Park, which was probably pretty good with the Dead, we didn't mesh too well. Had I known that there was going to be that many people and was that much pressure towards a lower stage about, it was maybe 400 high, which would have been 4 feet. Difficult. We were not using the follow spots because the union labor that was required to operate them didn't show up because they knew they had heard all about the concerns of just on the radio. So, and it was a blessing. Here's one of these blessings that usually follow us. If we had used front light follow spots on the act, then what would have happened would have been the act wouldn't have been able to protect themselves or see anything being thrown at them.
Right.
So all we had was backlight and then lots of people standing very close to the front of the stage, if not the Angels on the stage. They were reflecting just enough for Albert Maisel's to film Gimme Shelter. So with the 48,000 watts of backlight we had in white, it bounced off those people and gave Albert and his brother the exposure that they needed. So everything has a habit of working out. But very early in the morning, after that concert, I saw the stage rug sitting on leaning on the roof to the end of the tailgate. And that rug belonged to production, and I would imagine that I would have been charged for it had it not been returned. And also in that truck was this, a chopper on a motorcycle on either side. So as the truck started to pull out, I just grabbed the end of the rug and assumed that it would just pull off the off its position on the pickup. Unfortunately, it did, and one of the choppers came out with it, and I managed to stay reasonably protected and calm for 15 minutes while talking to a number of the angels in their distress about a bike being pulled off of the truck. And then somebody got me with a loaded pool cue, and that four teeth were missing. And no time to go to the dentist because I had to find out. I found out where Sonny Barger lived, and I went and got a case of champagne and a case of brandy and went prepared to buy the rug back and got it back.
We're talking with Chipmunk here on Downtown. How did you come to break Mick Jagger's finger?
I threw a small Xerox machine at him. Unfortunately, he got a little out of hand. But he then was polite enough as to keep his distance. And because what I wanted to do with the group was just, essentially build a brand, which we did successfully. But in 69, the first tour of the U.S. that they'd done since 66, I went to Boston and saw them from New York when I was working at the gate in 66, and they were pretty rough. They did maybe 35, 45 minutes, no encore. And as Charlie Watts said politely, maybe it was their youthful exuberance, or that they were just too damn selfish to want to do anything else other than get in the car and collect the money and get home. Charlie's extremely intelligent and did most of the artwork on album covers and everything else in the very beginnings with a little bit of Andrew Olin. It's really hard to reach his ladyship unless you have, what you've got to do is you've got to meet Jagger, whether summoned or your request to have a meeting of sorts. In the first maybe 30 seconds, you have to figure out which of the seven personalities you're speaking to. And otherwise, you don't have the right pin configuration, and you'll be discharged, or he'll just walk out to do something else. So it was difficult.
Chip, did you find it useful, and maybe even essential, to distance yourself from some of these big stars to do the job you had to do?
Yes, they don't need a friend because they've got all these people that are hounding them anyway. I'm usually distant, but you know there are times that I need something to make the unit work, or there's something that's being left undone that isn't been attended to, and you know, therefore you have to present it to somebody. And Charlie gets tired, basically, of being the person that has to carry your message to his ladyship.